following the performance of the play Night Over Taos, three wonderful New Mexico historians took the stage and had a fascinating discussion about the questions raised by the play and about New Mexico's long journey from defeat in the Battle of Taos in 1847 to statehood in 1912.
Now, it's my great pleasure to welcome the panel of New Mexico historians who have agreed to talk about what we've just seen and the issues that it raises, and I'd like to introduce the panel. On my immediate left is Dr. Rick Hendricks, the state historian of New Mexico, and in the middle is Dr. Laura Gomez, who is professor of law and American studies at UNM, and author of a fascinating book about the territorial period in New Mexico called Manifest Destinies. And at the end is Dr. Brian Herrera, assistant professor of theater history and performance theory at the University of New Mexico. One of the things that a centennial project must do when they deal with history is be accurate. And Maxwell Anderson was a playwright, not a historian. And we have historians here prepared to tell us what Maxwell Anderson got right and what he didn't get so right. First of all, I think maybe a brief description, Rick, of the Mexican War in New Mexico. What happened before the play started?
Well, the Mexican War in New Mexico really is a story of the invasion of Mexico by the United States. It's not typically told that way, but that's in fact what it was. General Kearny came to New Mexico, made a number of statements that were proved to be inaccurate about what his plans were for New Mexico and the authority that he had, basically saying that you are now going to become part of the United States. There was only one major battle that took place as part of the war proper, which is another very poorly known battle, the Battle of Brasito, which took place on December 25th, Christmas Day, 1846, south of Las Cruces. That was where Mexican regular army met the United States Army. It was a rout. Most military observers would have said that when Mexico confronted the United States that the Mexican army probably would win very handily, but that didn't turn out to be the case. So in terms of the formal military conflict in New Mexico, it was relatively brief. Now the context for the play has to do with the winter of 1846-1847. And in terms of the historicity of the play, one of the main issues is the context. The play, particularly in the words of Pablo Montoya, describes Taos as an enclave of Spanish Empire, somehow removed from Mexico and very much still part of Spain. But if we look at the main participants in the rebellion of 1847, what we see is that this was very much a Mexican reaction to the fact that the United States had invaded. It really doesn't have anything to do with Spain anymore. In the play, Pablo Montoya is a man of 60 years old. Now, we don't know a lot about his biography, but what we do know was in 1847, he was in his 31st year. He was a young man. He was born in 1816. He would have had very little appreciation, probably, for ever having been a part of the Spanish Empire. Mexican independence would have come when he was 5 years old. So, again, we don't know an awful lot about him other than the fact that he was a young man. He probably was a landowner. Whether he would have been considered a rico is hard to say. And the play presents his demise at his own hand when I think he could very well be considered a Mexican patriot, executed by the United States. The other principal character, and Padre Martinez, he is given a particular role in the play, and the truth is that we really don't know very much about Padre Martinez's participation. It's certainly not clear-cut. And the other thing is that there seems to be some notion that this is led by what are referred to as the ricos. And from all appearances, it was a popular revolt. It had elite participation, but it also had a lot of popular participation. So those are just sort of things that I would point to that we would want to have in mind as we looked at the play.
Laura Gomez, you've done a lot of research on the Taos Revolt. Would you like to add a little bit to this?
Let me jump in and just really continue along some of the lines that Rick has started us. I think there are probably three things that I would add to sort of just enrich your understanding of the revolt. When we talk about the Taos Revolt, what we're talking about is in mid-January 1847, the assassination of Governor Bent, the American governor, by a group of Mexican men from Taos and Taos Pueblo men working together. And the Indian participation is written entirely out of the play and actually out of a lot of historical coverage, not that there's so much, but of that historical coverage that exists, it's often written out of it. The other thing that is interesting here, right? So this is January of 1847. The American invasion happened about 6 months before, and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which the U.S. Senate ratifies to end the war, happens in May of 1848, so more than a year later. So we are in a period where this is contested territory, literally contested and certainly politically contested. And the historical heritage that we have about the period is that it was a bloodless conquest. And this period of resistance, which started in Taos but spread to several other northern New Mexico communities, is a reminder that it was not a bloodless conquest, that there was actually very significant popular resistance, and there were thousands of people who were killed during this period of time, including many civilians by the U.S. military. And there were hundreds of men who were arrested for the murder of Bent. Somewhere between 17 and 22 were executed after trials in which they were convicted for being traitors to the U.S. during a period when the U.S. didn't have control of the region and had invaded it. So these were Mexican patriots, as Rick says, but convicted, right, in these sham trials and then executed without the right to appeal. But one thing that strikes me about the play is to think, well, then what was the purpose of it? What was going on that was leading Ferguson and then leading Anderson to this particular myth-making? What role did it really serve? And I think it fits very, very nicely and powerfully within a particular story, a particular narrative about New Mexico history, which was very useful to the Americans at the time of the conquest, and particularly to the Euro-Americans who were still trying to continue the conquest in the 20th century. In other words, in the 20th century, it was trying to continue the political conquest of New Mexico. And so to me, what I see in the play is the story that helps justify that political and economic conquest in the 20th century, because it was American progress and the future that was displacing this decaying and decrepit Spanish culture, which was epitomized by this portrayal of this backward, sexist, misogynist kind of society. I was thinking it's not unlike what we are saying today about the Middle East and how we justify our incursions into that backward society. You know, we're better than them, and here's one of the reasons why. So I think that was powerful to me, more powerful to me in seeing the reading tonight than it had been when I had just read the play.
And to add just a little bit of theatrical context to that, if I might, I think that one of the features of this that really came through for me in the reading as well is how it fits very neatly in a tradition of theatrical representation of the American Southwest, which sort of stages a narrative decay, chaos, and then conquest or progress. There's a variety of productions that sort of none of them deal with New Mexico. Most deal with California in the sort of the elaboration of the mission narrative. And what was striking to me listening to this today as well is just how much this actually is of a piece with a number of other Southwestern portrayals from about 20 years earlier. Plays by Belasco, Pageant, the Mission play, or the Pageant of Ramona, how all of these sort of do stage a moment of the triumph of Spanish presence, its decay into a space of chaos that then awaits a future. And the future tends to be narratively embodied by the arrival of Anglos in some way. And so we don't often see the arrival of them coming over the horizon, but the decline, the sort of the romantic tragedy of the piece ends up being about, like, this is the ruins that we now find ourselves. The we, of course, tacitly is addressing the Anglo spectator.
Laura, you mentioned the omission of Native Americans in the play. There was, I gather, someone named Tomas Romero, who was, along with Pablo Montoya, a leader in this rebellion. Is that right?
Yeah, Pablo Montoya was the leader of the Mexican wing of the resistance, and Tomas Romero was the Taos Pueblo leader. And one thing that is interesting is that they met very different fates. Although, you know, I want to emphasize it's not as if it's very clear-cut what we know about this period and what we know about what happened. But in the play, they're talking about the conflict in Embudo. And there was a conflict there in which the Americans suffered heavy losses. And then basically the Americans went back to Santa Fe to fortify and started coming further north. And the resistors ended up eventually going to the church at Taos Pueblo. So they end up barricading themselves there in the church, and the Americans finally make their way up there and then shoot cannons at the church for 2 days to finally get to them. And that's when they capture Romero and Montoya. So a very different ending than what's portrayed in the play. And the point that I was going to make was that the different treatment in terms of how the Americans treated the Indian leader and the Mexican leader, the Indian was executed summarily, and the Mexican, Montoya, was actually court-martialed and then executed. So there was this, you know, this sense in which you would not treat an Indian with that kind of respect. To actually court-martial him and then execute him.
One of the questions that begs to be discussed is Padre Martinez and what his role was in this. In the play, he's part of the rebellion, at least at first. Is that reasonably accurate?
We don't really know what his role was in the rebellion. It's pretty clear that the words of the pragmatic accommodation that he immediately jumps to would not have been words he would have uttered in 1847. We do know that in 49 he is involved in an attempt to draft the documents that would establish a territory. And then again in 1850 he's involved in an attempt to make a constitution. Now, one of the steps to statehood was to have a constitution and have it approved. And so I think it's entirely possible that had he been successful that particular time, maybe New Mexico would have been a state in 1850 and he would be the hero of New Mexico statehood. That possibility existed there briefly in 1850, and of course we know that then we begin a long and torturous road to statehood where the lowest common denominator of bigotry is probably the outstanding reason that we didn't get there. Post-rebellion, he plays a very important role as a politician. He serves in the legislature on several occasions. He's perhaps best known for his role as what I would call a defender of the Mexican expression of Catholicism in conflict with Lamy. So he plays a very important role as a statesman and also as a religious leader.
I want to come back to Rick's point about statehood. So the U.S. invades Mexico in New Mexico in 1846. The Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo ends the war in 1848. It's not until 1850 that Congress designates New Mexico a federal territory. And that was in the Compromise of 1850, which also involved statehood for California, where gold had been discovered, coincidentally, the year before. And in 1845, Texas had received statehood. So what was different about these other places? Well, there was a lot more drawing Euro-Americans to California and Texas. And in fact, by actually the 1830s, Texas is dominated by Euro-Americans, and Mexicans are in the minority as a political force. And in California, that happens really rapidly. And by 1850, that's the situation. New Mexico doesn't have the same draw in terms of drawing people here, Euro-American immigrants, and Mexicans dominate politically and demographically for a long time. And I think that was Rick's reference to the bigotry. That is the distinction. And, you know, that's the 64-year delay until 1912 statehood, which, of course, is a great reason, I think, to have this conversation and think more about this period, centennial.
And it is quite fraught period. And one of the ways that New Mexico sort of eludes the cultural and theatrical imaginary is it remains apart from, whereas California is already incorporated as part of the United States, but New Mexico remains apart from the United States. It's a period when Albert Beveridge is the one who's in charge of the Philippines after 1898, has particularly suspicious views of New Mexican culture, and it's an era that's quite fraught in the way that New Mexico is, can it be part of the self-governing statehood? Can it be part of the sisterhood of states? And that's that's the antecedents of why this, I think in some ways, New Mexico and it eludes this romance of the Southwest in a lot of mainstream cultural writing.
New Mexico and Arizona both.
To an extent. Arizona, yeah. there's a boom of plays that are produced in the aughts. Belasco does two California dramas in like 05 and 08. One's called Girl of the Golden West, which talks about the 49ers and sort of talks about Northern California. And then Rose of the Rancho, which is about the Southland and the mission landscape. So he does these big, and they tour nationally and they're enormously successful. At the same time, Augusta Stone pens a number of sort of romances, sort of cowboy westerns. But each year there's a new one. And then like it starts, Arizona's a giant hit in like 1902. And Colorado comes shortly thereafter. There's even a Utah. So all four corners are represented. New Mexico is the one that Stone doesn't write a play about. And I think that that is just a really emblematic metaphor of sort of the challenge that New Mexico had in moving to statehood. You could all, even with the Mormons, you could wrap your brain around Utah. But there was something about New Mexico that was the exemption. And, I mean, this is the period of that insane jointure movement. That, like, the point of the Southwestern fad on American stages was the period of the most fraught and most sort of overt bigotry about New Mexico, and can New Mexico ever be incorporated into what is widely called the sisterhood of states?
So what is behind that?
I think that that's...
Racism.
Racism. Well, I think linguistic and cultural autonomy. I mean, that's the other piece, that there is an existing set of governmental structures that are perceived by many as being sort of a separate state. And there is also the lack of personhood invested in Native America. So when the idea of the part of the big movement of jointure of trying to make New Mexico and Arizona one state is that the numbers of the people go up because you count Native Americans as population, but they don't have any access to voting rights. And so by sort of incorporating Arizona with its relatively small Spanish-speaking population, you can sort of end up sort of making a minority out of New Mexico. And that was the overt argument about why jointure made sense.
There was also a cynical calculus that was made by the East that New Mexico joining, at least in terms of the Senate, would get two senators. States like Pennsylvania and New York found that incredibly offensive because New Mexico was full of too many Roman Catholics, too many Hispanics, which made them ignorant. So I think that behind the bigotry, which is what I consider to be, as I said, the lowest common denominator, that's what they argued, but there was also a political calculus behind that. We don't want another state in from the... We certainly don't want that state in.
The period leading up to statehood, and I think we hear the anxieties of it ghosting in the play today, is this question of assimilability. And I think you see that even in the way the character of Diana is depicted, as she is the model of a future of an assimilability. And there is a real deep anxiety in terms of both civic and linguistic autonomy among Nuevo Mexicanos that that might be a bar to their ability to be assimilated into the United States. So there's a variety of things, but I do think linguistic autonomy is also a big deal. The fact that there is a bilingual constitution, that Beveridge is especially appalled when he tours the region, to find magistrates who speak broken English but conduct their courts in Spanish. And he finds that, and he goes back and says, this is proof that this state is not ready, that we can hold on to them as a territory like we do the Philippines, and we can be their imperial overlord, but they cannot enter the ranks of self-governing that the statehood requires.
There's another way to come back to gender in this part of the story also, though, because I think one of the elements of the racism was a resentment of the fact that Mexican men were empowered as electors and as officials here, which was the great compromise of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And there was much resistance to it in the Senate, to the idea of enfranchising Mexican men. Pueblo men were not enfranchised, but Pueblo men had been enfranchised under the Mexican government. So what I argue that's going on here was an exchange of two Mexican men. We will give you this sort of limited white status, which includes this right to vote. We will make sure that Indians don't get that. And it was a sort of a compromise with the devil kind of a thing, right? So that part of the reason that statehood, I think, was resisted was because it was known that Mexican men would control the political process, right? And that was delayed until there was a time when there was a sufficient Anglo presence to be able to dislodge that. And I think that that actually also plays nicely into the narrative of the play, right? And this isn't so long after statehood, this narrative of it's the Mexican men who were dangerous and who were old-fashioned and who were in this decaying kind of culture. The women wanted to be free. The women were already having sex with Anglo men in the play, right? And Anglo men were entitled to that. And then you get this very strange thing of this Anglo-female captive, this, right? That storyline serves a particular purpose to demonize Mexican men who had some significant political power at that point. Still limited. I don't want to overstate that because it wasn't a state, their power was limited, right? Every law that this territorial legislature could pass could be overturned by Congress in those 64 years. But it was still political power.
The territorial politics get really intricate at this point. As territorial government becomes increasingly operational, it develops its own internal political culture, which has very different allegiances outside of the state as well. And also, I think the periodizing moment, from my perspective as an entertainment historian, is the railroad comes comparatively late in the 1880s, and that shifts the demographic, both in terms of bifurcating North and South, and also in terms of sort of localizing certain towns and cities as bringing a new and additional influx. And so I think there's a variety of these different waves, like that moment of 1850 when it passes. There's all these other large national trends that end up being some of the features that have to be negotiated with each effort towards statehood. Like there's all these moments mm-hmm. where it almost happened and then political culture shift, or there was a big demographic change or another kind of like a war kind of thing coming along. And then there's also a variety of mixed priorities in terms of the territory of the people resident here, of whether or not this is a major fight to fight for, like among residents versus business interests versus there's different investments mm-hmm. in what statehood might mean for people who Anglo and non-Anglo.
Well, on three separate occasions, we basically stopped ourselves. I mean, we had to have the Constitution. We voted the Constitution down twice. And then when the Constitution came up with the jointure, we voted that one down. So it got increasingly complicated. You could almost say that statehood came with the railroad, because it's not an accident that in the decade 1900 to 1910, somewhere in that decade, New Mexico ceases to be majority Mexican. 2 years later, we get statehood. I don't think that's a complete accident, and that really is a byproduct of the railroad.
In terms of the historical significance of the play disappears from Maxwell Anderson's biography, literally. Like, it's not indexed in like the big opus about his life. And so the play sort of disappears. And what's interesting to me about the play is it remains the only play presented on Broadway that deals specifically with New Mexico history and historical figures. 20 years after statehood, there's a play on Broadway about New Mexico history. In the 80 years since statehood, we've had some settings from Sam Shepard, Mark Medoff, right? We've had some people singing about the idea of Santa Fe and rent. But we haven't actually had a New Mexico history or something that really is rooted deeply in the historical topics, trends, themes of what New Mexico is in terms of the limited view of American theater that localizes it in New York. And I do think if you compare that with nearly almost any other state, that won't be the case. There might maybe Anderson also cursed the Dakotas, but but it is a peculiar way. And it goes to me in terms of statehood and the struggle to statehood always reminds me of that last page in New Mexico Magazine of One of Our 50 is Missing. There's a conceptual gap in trying to understand how New Mexico is a part of the United States. And we can see that in culture as well. I don't know that I would consider Night Over Taos a New Mexico play, but the fact that it remains the only play about New Mexico to ever be presented on Broadway in 80 years does signal, I think, something very continuingly of interest. That is sort of the way the history that led to statehood actually in some ways continues after statehood, of how is New Mexico a part of the Union.
We had spoken before, Brian, about Harvey Ferguson and Erna Ferguson and their particular Ferguson view of New Mexico history.
And the Fergusons had an enormous impact in terms of introducing the idea of actual New Mexico to a broader readership. And this was a moment in the later 1920s, and especially the early 1930s, when there was this awareness in certain levels of Anglo culture beyond New Mexico of why are people going to New Mexico? What is that thing? And Erna Ferguson ended up being one of the key ambassadors of telling stories of New Mexico history. And then Harvey, her younger brother, didn't stay as long in the New Mexico biz as Erna did. He wrote a few things early in his career and late in his career. But for all of them, they did rehearse what I, as a public school student in New Mexico in the 1970s, learned as truth, as fact, as the tricultural heritage. First there were Indians, and then there were the Spanish, and then came the Anglos, and that's why we have New Mexico. That sort of narrative, you know, it's this notion of succession. And the ways that that notion of cultural succession get rehearsed in specific relation to New Mexico, we can trace a lot back to the Fergusons. And most of what they did are good opening shots of beginning to tell this history in a way that is legible to readers outside the state. So their legacy is a rich and important one. But it also rehearses the tricultural heritage, which many of us now refer to as tricultural myth or other kinds of language that interrogate the implicit assumptions of superiority that a narrative succession can tend to rehearse as well.
And the play really fits nicely into, right? Yeah. It's really sort of, this is the play saying goodbye to that past, and there's good reasons that we want to say goodbye to it, and even, you know, the son is saying goodbye to it. We want to put that to rest, and we want to move on to where the action is and progress is, which is with the Anglos, and that's the future.
And that's the pivot of Padre Martinez as well. It's like he sort of models that more
exactly,
explicitly.
Need to manufacture a Spanish past occurs because of the rupture of the American conquest and the, I think, pretty intense racism that the Mexicans here felt. And so there becomes this, and also it served many interests of the Anglo promoters too, to sort of say there's a Spanish mythology, right? That was part of the exotic attraction that starts in the late 19th century and then really picks up steam in those first several decades of the 20th century.
And it's telling, I think, that the one person who speaks aloud, the question of what are these people here, is the crazy old woman who talks about the blood of Spain. Will it be turned red with the Indians, or will it be white? And so that's placed in the mouth of a female character who's placed even further at the margins than almost any other female character, but is nonetheless almost always speaking precise truths, is an interesting way of localizing that anxiety around what's going on.
That happened again in the 1930s. In the Depression, there was a big uptick of anti-Mexican. Everybody wanted jobs. Mexican laborers were suddenly not as valued as they had always been before. It was less in New Mexico. It was very severe in some other places. Texas was horrible. But Colorado would not allow people from New Mexico that happened to be guilty of traveling while brown. Couldn't cross the border into Colorado. So I had wondered if maybe he had picked up on that. Since the play is 32, I don't know whether he...
In 1930 was the year the census designated Mexican.
Right.
You know, it was that one year. So it could have been, and he was definitely traveling in the literate circles, but there is something that he's astute about, the ways that there is a racial anxiety. The play sort of plays with that, but doesn't really go to any coherent finish on what race means.
We have a question from a member of the audience about whether there was resistance to statehood.
There was resistance. I think I mentioned that on three occasions New Mexicans voted down the Constitution, which was a necessary step. And I think Brian was also addressing that in talking. There were a variety of economic reasons. Is this better? Is it not better? Is the territorial status better? I've worked with some documents from Anglo relatively recently arrived in New Mexico in the 1870s, and some of their letters back to family in Illinois, and they're saying these people are not ready for statehood. So I think it varied all over the place. At least it wasn't overwhelmingly clear in those instances when the step needed to be made for the Constitution. However, they did get the Constitutions drafted and put before the public. When you're a territory, you're not fully enfranchised. You don't get to vote for president. You don't get to send your own voting representatives to Congress. To me, that's always been really the single most important thing. I mean, I've been asked as state historian, what is the most important thing about statehood? Well, qualified voters were not fully enfranchised. Of course, we're talking 1912. We're not talking everybody. We haven't gotten to women yet, and we don't get to Native Americans until 1948. The federal law allows them to have a vote, but the states can make their own rules, and so in New Mexico, we don't get it. So you always have to qualify that. Say the qualified voters were disenfranchised until that moment, and I think that's key. And we were not fully selecting the people that were governing the state as well. But we could go, and the legislature could meet, and then that could be knocked down in Washington.
I'm not aware of any organized political resistance to statehood, but there's a lot of currents that can suggest a deep and considered ambivalence. So I think that there's broad currents aware of what might be compromised in terms of the traditions and autonomy that New Mexico had utilized through several nationhoods at that point, that might be compromised if fully accessed.
I think ambivalence is exactly the right word, right? And so that even as we think about this moment of Taos revolt and sort of the legacy, I interviewed a woman who was an eighth generation descendant of one of the resistors who had been executed. And she said, these stories have been passed down in our family. And, you know, we have some mixed feelings about them. We don't talk very publicly about it, but we say, you know, they had good reason to do what they did. And the ambivalence comes from the fact that those of us who have those ties going back further, and most of us who have those ties have many ongoing ties with Mexico also over that time period and with various indigenous peoples here as well. You are of this new place and also of Mexico and of these other places. And so there is that ongoing, I think, ambivalence.
Now I would like to give the panelists an opportunity, each of you, to make a kind of closing statement if you care to do so.
I think the play, whatever your reaction to the play is evokes just how rich and how complicated the strands of the journey to statehood were and how the struggle to represent them remains ongoing. And it's a great story of New Mexico history, and it's a story that not everybody talks about. Like, statehood geeks might talk about it, but not everybody else does. It's a story worth knowing about because it actually says a great deal about how New Mexico has been part of the United States for the last 100 years. Pretty much everything that goes on in the statehood struggle, we can hear traces of that in the 100-year sense. It's a story that might have seemingly finished in January when Governor McDonald sort of said, welcome to New Mexico. But every conflict that led to statehood is a conflict that continues in New Mexico. And that's why I think it remains one of the more important stories that most New Mexicans don't know a lot.
I'll say a few things just to relate to contemporary events. Two things. One, to pick up on what Brian said earlier, which is this moment that we're in, which is an intensely anti-Mexican, anti-immigrant period. And it's not new. We've cycled through that. And we're in a particularly intense period right now in the U.S. And it seems to me that people who care about justice need to speak up and speak out. And hopefully that will mean that period will end sooner rather than later. And the other contemporary moment is people talking about Puerto Rican statehood right now. And there you get the same kinds of, you know, we tend to think, we'd like to look to history and we tend to think it would be great if there's a neat story and we could have it wrapped up nicely. But it's as complex as our present is, right? And so if you look at the present historical moment and the debates in Puerto Rico and in Congress and so forth about Puerto Rican status, it's incredibly complicated and rich and but whenever I hear those debates, and I always think back to the resonances with New Mexico and how the New Mexico story ended up differently than the Puerto Rican story, which begins with the U.S. in 1898. So it's just interesting to think about some of those present situations which remind us of our complex history.
Thank you very, very much for coming and being on the panel and sharing your thoughts and ideas with us.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Night Over Taos, a theatrical and historical journey from the Taos Revolt to statehood. The production of the play was supported by a generous grant from the Century Arts Foundation, and the historian panel you've just heard was made possible by a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council. This has been a special New Mexico Centennial edition of KUNM's Radio Theater. If you missed any part of the broadcast, you'll be able to hear it on KUNM's two-week archive on our website, kunm.org. This is Linda Lopez McAllister saying thank you so much for joining us in this special centennial edition of KUNM's Radio Theater. Happy anniversary, New Mexico.